This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins, The Financial Lives of the Poets, or The Zero, and help keep the show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook, a 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than a jetpack, a spider bite, ouch, and a half-baked coat of honor to be a hero. Yay. Okay, so I am here once again with Jess Walter, who is most recently the author of Beautiful Ruins. Jess, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to have you back.
I'm great, Ed. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Good. So I'd like to start off with a sentiment that is expressed late in the book, because I think it really encapsulates what this novel is about. But aren't all great quests folly? El Dorado and the Fountain of Youth and the search for intelligent life in the cosmos. We know what's out there. It's what isn't that truly compels us. And in this passage, you suggest that true quests, they aren't measured in time and distance, they're actually measured in home. So, to my mind, this is also a very good description of writing.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, how you countered this idea of knowing what's out there while writing Beautiful Ruin, and this notion of the quest that guided all these considerable styles, considerable characters, considerable decades, considerable locations, all crammed quite majestically into a 350-page narrative. So, you know, what steps do you take to find that quest, and also to make sure you're not writing the same novel twice?
Well, I haven't had a problem writing the same novel twice.
Yeah.
The novel very much, I think, is a reflection of the way I work and the things that I think are important in fiction writing. And that passage you talk about, this novel I started in 1997 and
yeah.
I kept putting down.
Wow.
So it was that sort of journey. It was very much one of those quests that took me to different styles of writing and different places, to Edinburgh, to Italy, to England, to, you know, different places in the United States, and every time I would come back to it, the thing itself would kind of be about storytelling.
Yeah.
Those beautiful ruins that of the title to me are the artifacts that make up this piece.
Sure.
The lives are reflected in the stories that we tell about ourselves. So it was a bit of a meta experience for me writing this. I kept feeling as if I was commenting on the writing of the book itself.
Yeah.
As through this big storytelling voice, this third person omniscient, where I was able to just grab a character and tell you everything you needed to know about them, that idea of storytelling kept coming around in a big, grand way.
1997, so what shape, what direction was what became Beautiful Ruins like back then? I ask because there's this tantalizing bit at the very beginning where, oh, Jess is going to write a Scientology satire, a send-up, and then, psych, no, it's not that story at all, kind of nicely mimicking the whole, you know, Lydia's peril story near the end. So this would explain, if you worked on it for so many years, why it became so mammoth and complex, but I'm wondering what the prototypical version of this looked like.
Yeah, I like that idea of having the word psych every three or four pages.
Yeah.
Psych! You thought it was going to be this psych? We have to talk to the audiobook people about that. I'll just lean over the actor's shoulder and say psych every few minutes.
That'd probably be a good read to read the David Foster Wallace footnotes.
It would, yeah. Yeah.
Psych!
Psych! Yeah. But, I went to Italy in 1997 before I'd published any novels, and I'd been working on two novels that would fail, that would just never be published, and this was my third failed novel.
Uh-huh.
In my mind. It was called at the time The Hotel Adequate View. My mom had been diagnosed with cancer, and I originally thought I would write a sort of magical realism piece about a woman dying of cancer who goes to this small Italian village where, for some mystical reason, her cancer stops.
Yeah.
And it was really just a way to kind of take my mom to this place she'd never gotten to see. And then I started tweaking with the idea. I didn't want to write that book about my mom, but I still had this woman arriving in this village and this man, Pasquale Tursi, seeing her. And I had to figure out who was this woman.
Yeah.
And I started, I my first book had been made into a miniseries on CBS, yes. Ruby Ridge, in 1995. So I'd had my first dealings with Hollywood. And so I thought, she's an actress. So in 1997, I had this idea that she was an actress. I'd already looked up Cleopatra. I thought she was looking at, she was part of that. I even had the sort of parallel stories. But I really just hit a wall. I didn't know how to write that novel then. It was more ornate than I think I was capable of doing. So I stepped aside and I wrote Over Tumbled Graves, which was a crime novel that I outlined that, you know, and I, like a lot of young writers, I was really teaching myself how to write a novel.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the chops then to write this book.
So out of the early version came this fixation on serial killers. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had been a cop reporter.
Yeah, I know.
And so when I turned to what, you know, I did what every young writer does, write what you know. You know, yeah. You don't know Italy. You don't know Hollywood. I lacked the confidence, I guess, to finish it. And I also didn't know where the story was going. I mean, it becomes about the span of these lives. And I hadn't had as much life as I've had now. I hadn't had that span. So I wrote Over Tumbled Graves. When I finished it, I went back to the Hotel Adequate View. Still couldn't crack it. Wrote The Land of the Blind. Went back to it. Still couldn't crack it. Wrote Citizen Vince. And this kept happening on and on and on. Finally, in 2008, July of 2008, I finished a draft of it. It was now called Beautiful Ruins.
Yeah.
I gave it to a friend of mine and I read it and it still didn't work. And so I set it aside and I wrote The Financial Lives of the Poets in about 8 months. And as a kind of palate cleanser, because by now it had grown to this puzzle with all these pieces that I could sort of intuit how they fit together, but I couldn't quite get them to work that way.
This is fascinating to me. So you had to write several novels to get to the end of this, to get to the end of the draft.
Yeah, right.
This suggests to me, perhaps, that, you know, because you were mimicking several styles within the course of this book, that each incremental step forward was almost a new style, almost like a mini novel, I suppose. Is that safe to say? Or?
You know, not really, because I would go back to the beginning, beginning. There's not a sentence that exists that was in that original version. Every time I would go back to it, I'd be left with Pasquale and Dee.
Yeah.
Most of the rest of it didn't quite makes sense to me. Michael Dean exists in some form. I probably discovered Richard Burton in about 2006 that I wanted to write about him. But there were just odds and ends and bits and pieces that would make their way into it. But it was more it really is like a 3D puzzle the way it fits together. And while it's sort of complex in structure, I never wanted it to be complex in narrative.
Yeah.
I always wanted it to be a story that pushed forward. And there's a central question. This couple meets, and are they going to get back together 50 years later? You know, and I, as long as that was hovering over it, I felt like I could do all these other pieces. So I went to Italy again after I finished The Financial Lives of the Poets. I went to speak, a friend was teaching there, and I went to speak to his class. And I went, hiked the Cinque Terre again, and I had this burst of understanding of what was missing. I stayed up, wrote 26 pages in my journal, my writing journal, of notes. And the last note I wrote was, it's morning, the birds are chirping, I've stayed up all night. And and in there was a kind of outline description of what I thought the novel should do. I didn't follow all those rules, but it was a nice path to get me through this last burst of writing it. And when I finished it this last time, I had a sense that this is it. You know, this is the book that I wanted to write before I knew what it was.
So would you say that during this period of writing this novel and also writing several other novels, that really it was a matter with Beautiful Ruins of giving yourself almost permission to set down at least a tentative structure so you can actually push forward? Is that really the breakthrough with this?
Well, every writer knows that feeling of something that fails.
Yeah.
And I never thought it was going to succeed, honestly. Every time I hit a wall with it, I thought, well, that thing's done.
Sure.
Because I've had other novels that peter out after however many pages. So it wasn't that I lacked the structure because I thought I knew what it was. It just didn't work. And it just wasn't right. And I always write two or three things at once. It's my one superpower, that, and I'm a really good driver. So I write poems at the same time I write essays, at the same time I write reviews, and I just sit at the desk, and if I'm stuck on one thing, I work on something else. So I've got two novels going now, and I don't know which one will grab me.
Race to the finish.
Yeah, and I might finish it and decide it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But the structure that I imposed on it the last time was a little more generous structure. I think I was even more indulgent with myself and trying on the reader in earlier drafts. And this time I said, I'm going to make sure that you're rewarded when you have to start over and meet new characters. That when things come back around, there's a payoff. And I knew Alvis Bender, this writer from World War II, would figure in it, and I knew I wanted to have a pitch for a film called about the Donner Party.
Sure. In there.
I knew these pieces, and so I trimmed a lot of those and made them shorter so that it was less trying on the reader. I tried to make the connections more complete, and I always sensed that the novel would make or break on the last chapter when I had this idea that I wrote in my journal in Italy in 2008 that everything would swirl back around in this big present tense.
Yeah. So here's the big question. I mean, to devote so many years to a novel, clearly the styles probably kept you amused to a large degree, but I mean, how did you not get sick of Pasquale and Desmarais for all that time? Did you have to constantly reinvent them to find out, why they were these great romantic comic figures on the page that you could just breathe to life further?
I think two things. One, nothing clears you of, I hated them. There were times when I thought, I never want to see these characters again. I never want to read these sentences. And every writer goes through those phases. To me, it's like a bellows of grandiosity and hatred where, oh my God, this is brilliant. Oh my God, this is horrible. And I had all of those moments. And like I said, I just assumed the novel probably wouldn't work. But the thing that will cleanse your palate of the bad tastes that a novel has is writing another novel.
Yeah.
And so to write, and that's why Financial Lives of the Poets is a just lean, straightforward, one person over 4 days narrative, complete, linear story. And I purposefully said I'm not going to have any writerly things in there. I'm going to just strip all that away and write. And just have fun, and so that then cleared my palate, and that was a year out of, it was 8 months of writing, and then which was the fastest I've ever produced anything, and then when I went back to Beautiful Ruins, I felt fresh with it again, and I was also able to see those things that didn't work and to tear them away.
Do you think that with Financial Lives responding to the 2008 economic meltdown in some sense, that maybe this was perhaps your duty? Perhaps to write a social novel of some kind, even though you had no clear ambitions to write a social novel, just to get this visceral reaction out through Financial Lives, because this was the thing that was getting in the way of pushing forward on Beautiful Ruins. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I like characters who are in over their heads.
Yeah.
And so I put Matt in over his head, and I gave him the anxieties that I have, about am I going to be able to put my kids through college? Yeah. I just recently got my house tax assessment, and our house is valued at the exact same price we paid for it 10 years ago. And I just thought, is that a missing decade, And
you have it better than a lot of people.
A lot of people
have seen a big dip.
Right,
I was talking to a friend the other day.
If you bought 5 years ago, then the fact that we bought 10 years ago,
this person bought 15 years ago in their house.
We sort of bought, we bought sort of mid rise. And we also live in a place where real estate values don't go up and down that much. But I remember thinking a lot of people would be disappointed, but I thought, hey, it's like I'm 10 years younger. But I was funneling a lot of those anxieties into Matt Pryor and Financial Lives of the Poets. And so, I think it was, I don't think of writing as having a social conscience like doing volunteer work but I do think you have to address those things that are going on in the culture around you. And with that book, I really wanted to address that sense of anxiety that was hanging over all of us. And with this one, it really became a book about fame and celebrity and how we tell our own stories and the choices we make and how they animate our lives.
Well, I'm wondering though, for you, with The Zero and the Financial Lives of the Poets, whether it's that a novelist, to a certain degree, has to exist in a bubble. Right. And yet, simultaneously, these books are responses to developments in the newspapers. You're a former reporter, as you said. And so, I'm wondering if this is kind of other question, whether this is possibly the stumbling block or simply the way you operate, that you have to, respond in some sense to our times. Is it safe to say?
Or? Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. Part of that, it probably is my journalist training, I mean, I feel like I am a novelist of my time. We all have those things that we read that inspire us in some way. And Albert Camus, I forget which essay it is, but he says in there that we should, that we need to write about the wager of our generation. He was talking, of course, about Algeria and World War II and, you know, various things that he wrote about, and that we have to create dangerously. We have to create in a place where we feel off balance and uncomfortable. Yeah. And, you know, especially since The Zero and through Financial Lives and through this book, I've gone to places as a writer where I, you know, where it makes me a little nervous, and I've tried to write about those things that feel like the wager of my generation, you know, that feel like, you know, the thing that's out there, the thing hovering over us all. So, yeah, probably journalism, but also probably just whatever it is we think a novelist is. And for me, when I see that, it is someone who looks at our times and tells us what they mean, or looks at the idea of romance and you know, and tries to reflect on what it means.
Yeah. So do you think that wager of our time, mm-hmm. that this has to be married in some sense to, you know, I suppose this entertaining streak that's in your books, because the last three have been very funny.
Oh, thanks.
And are very determined to entertain, but also entertain in the very poetic way. I think of the table leg sideburns, descriptions like that.
Yeah, thanks.
Which, you know, are just things I'm not going to get in any other book.
Oh,
but at the same time, it's entertaining, but it's also strangely poetic. Is this the, I suppose, way, because people complain, well, why aren't American novelists producing these big, fat, ambitious American Dreiser-like books, right? And we're just the publishing industry is kind of it's in a tenuous spot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm wondering if this has something to do with it, in whether your effort to invent through language or through entertainment has been a way to, you know, kind of meet the present exigencies of the publishing industry while also, you know, be true to this need, the wager inside you.
One great thing about living in Spokane, Washington is I think I'm totally unaware of the publishing industry except when I come here. So I think it has far more to do with the way I see the world. And, you know, I don't have an MFA. I'm not sure I have a BA. You know, I come from a very blue-collar family.
You're not sure you have a BA?
Well, let's not.
I don't want to dig too much into that.
Right. Well, I got a job at a newspaper my junior year in college. Yeah. And then the last year and a half of college was a lot of directed study. I didn't come at this from an academic place. I came at it as a person entertained and enthralled and changed by what they read. And that scent, that humor that lies beneath everything is as much a part of the way I look at the world as the way I write. And aware of that I need to entertain. And in fact, sometimes I can be a bit of a laugh whore, you know, that things will get tense in the room and, you know, I want one of my characters to slip and fall. You know? And I almost have to fight that more than anything, because what I want in the end is that, and I love intersections, I love unlikely intersections in books, and I love where the humorous intersects with the profound, where it intersects with the frightening. You know, Matt Pryor, it was the most anxious character, and yet I kept laughing as he would, you know, as he would stumble along his life. And I like those unlikely intersections.
So I suppose maybe what you're doing is inserting these, you know, these great social dilemmas in an effort to not be a laugh whore.
Yeah, maybe.
Something important there, you can't always crack the funnies. You
know? Right. Well, again, I think it has to do with what a novelist sees their job as, you know. And I've always thought that if you had a novelist in secret with no one looking, write their 10 favorite books down and looked at them, you'd have a pretty good track to see what they like to write, you know. And if I did that, I know there'd be some Vonnegut on there. I know Joan Didion's White Album would be on there. I know there'd probably be a Hemingway on there. I know that 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I almost think you could look at that list and find the DNA of most writers. And so, you know, Joan Didion in the White Album trying to capture that sense of late 60s, early 70s California angst and anxiety and paranoia, that capturing that moment in time, the journalistic brevity with which she writes, you know, is part of my DNA. Vonnegut's, you know, willingness to entertain and be funny and crack a joke in the you know, in the face of everything else. And I think Gabriel Garcia Marquez is a wildly funny writer who also tries to be inventive and and grand in ways. So, you know, I think most writers aren't really thinking about anything except in a really intuitive way the effects that of books, the effects that books had on them, and then trying to recreate that. And that's honestly, there's very little intent other than that. And then once you start a novel, it's the mechanics of making it all fit together and work.
So I have a question. Among this list of 10, is there a secret trashy book that you would be poo-pooing from certain literary
Movies?
Don't worry, you're on safe ground. I do read some trash.
No one's going to know that or that I don't have a college degree or that some of my...
No, but I mean, is there a book that gets dogged big time that has been a great inspiration to you?
Well, you know, it's funny because there's a book I find myself coming back to all the time, The Odessa File, by, not Follett, but... what's his name?
Frederick
Forsyth.
Yeah, Frederick Forsyth.
So, if you remember The Odessa File, it's about a reporter chasing Nazis. And you just sort of assume he's chasing Nazis because they're the bad guys. It's after World War II. It's in the 60s in Germany.
And it's also a preposterous Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah, I'd never saw the Clint Eastwood movie.
Yes, if it's the same.
Unless you're thinking of the Geiger Sanction.
I am, actually. The mountain climbing one.
Which
is a terrible movie, actually strangely entertaining in its awfulness.
Right. Well, in Frederick Forsyth's book, which is, you know, that there's a period of like 70s thrillers there, Marathon Man, you know. When you had those Nazis on the run, man, that was. But there's a point late in that book when you realize he's cornered the evil Nazi doctor and he's like, you know, you're a young German, why have you done this? And he says, you know, in the diary that I found about you, you were escaping and you were using these Jewish prisoners as a shield. And he said, we all did that, you know. And he said, no, it's not that. A young Wehrmacht officer tried to stop you and you shot and killed him. That was my father. And it's like, you know, 30 pages from the end. And I remember thinking at that moment, the best surprises in a book are surprises of motive. You know, the best shocks are that someone has been acting for a reason we didn't expect. And when I'm writing all the time, I will think, Odessa File. You know, I'll get stuck and I'll think, what if his motivation is something else? And it's amazing. So I think that's one that I could secretly put on my list. You know?
But that's, I mean, and I would agree with you that those moments of like, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I've been noticing that anytime you have a melodramatic gesture or some extraordinary pronouncement like that, there's tends to be this weird poo-pooing sometimes from literary culture. And so, you know, I agree with you that I think that a certain amount of melodrama is actually okay.
Well, it has to be earned. Yeah. I mean, if I read that book now, I would probably wince.
Yes,
but the effect is what I'm talking about. You know, if anything can be done well, you know, and no one ever knows how to describe literary fiction because... Yeah. What we really mean is the good stuff, you know?
Yes.
And how do you say that? You know, how do you exclude something? How do you include something? It's so arbitrary. And so it all becomes then a matter of technique and voice and style and maybe chutzpah in a bit, you know, in a way. And so, you know, I just read Martin Amis's Lionel Asbo.
Yes, I'm in the middle of it, and I saw that you raved about it,
I loved it. And there are a few things there that I just think, really? But... Yeah, really.
But you have to accept that in the Martin Amis novel.
Yeah, right. And that's what I love is that he will, you know, he will say that his anti-hero was first arrested at 3 years, 2 days, you know? And you know that when you're writing, you think, can I get away with five? And then to go to three, you know, is just kind of insane. So.
He has an absolute brazenness on the page it's so inspiring. And he's clearly having a ball.
And he's having a ball.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I will cling to is I like riffs. I like getting on the page and just having a riff take off out from under me. And like most writers, I think I'm trying to entertain myself and then hoping that other people will see the world the way I do.
Yeah. So just to get to less lofty topics.
Sure.
You know, I presume Alan Ladd was on your mind when you named Shane.
No, not really.
Oh, really? Okay. No, uh-huh. Well, and Dee Murray, I was thinking, oh, I wonder if he knows Rebecca De Mornay.
You know, I can't honestly say where the names come from. You know, I'll try different names. Every once in a while, a name will pop into my head, like Remy from The Zero, and yeah. I'll think... and then later I'll realize Jerry Remy, second base, Red Sox, 1977. Like a baseball card will flash in my head.
Well, what about Elvis Bender? What an extraordinary name.
I mean,
he's obviously, there are specific imbibing reasons for
right,
that name.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're a little bit like children. If you name them and it sticks, you know, it's hard to shift away. But, you know, I think I told you we went to Italy when I was in 1997, and there I stayed at the Albergo Pasquale. And so Pasquale's name always came from this hotel I stayed
wow.
at. And I've carried this in my wallet since 1997, just as a reminder that book is waiting for me.
How many times have you taken that photo out today, Jess?
Today? That's the first time.
Okay, yeah, good. I feel honored.
Yeah,
okay.
No. In fact, I didn't even remember it was there until I was looking for something for somebody to sign last night to give me their email address after the reading.
Yeah.
So, the names are... You know, they're kind of, you try to come up with them organically and, you know, you want them to describe the person. You know, Michael Dean at one time was named Robert Dean, and then I felt like it was so close to a Robert Evans character that I needed to change his first name. So.
Yeah. Well, going back to Table Lake sideburns,
sure.
There are also other interesting descriptions like the big lamb shank hand of Pelée. Lots of hyphenated descriptions along those lines, and lots of non-hyphenated stuff that tends to mimic the kind of description that you would often see in a Hollywood script. I was wondering, you know, if this was part of the purpose or how you come to ask you, like, how you come up with Table Lake sideburns. It's not really a fair question because often these combinations just happen. But, you know, I am curious if there was any effort on your part to just want to mimic that sort of Hollywood chronicling of narrative just really ridiculously over the top, chewy, juicy description.
Right. The whole book is kind of fanciful in that way, and I was glad that you know, some of the reviewers will note that it feels kind of blockbustery and washed out in that way. And so, I felt a few times like I was go big or go home, you know.
Yeah.
And but when the sentences themselves, I kind of always write that way. I look for a great riff, and if I'm on a great riff, I'll let it go and then go back and read it out loud and trim the stuff that doesn't work. I wasn't purposefully saying that this will, you know, the Hollywood sections. I was trying to do some of that, you know, and I was setting scenes in the way I was having establishing shots in my mind. Here's an establishing shot of Claire's neighborhood, and now we see the sprinklers, and now we go inside. You know, there were some sort of conscious decisions that reflected the, you know, those choices you make in screenwriting. But you know, and that is always the hardest question. How did you come up with this phrase? How did you come up with that? You know, and you know, you don't know. That's the fun part. I rewrite wildly up until the very last minute. I'm rewriting, and so I'm constantly tweaking with those things and trying to. And that's another collision I like, is an unexpected phrase, something you don't expect to describe, you know, the next thing.
Going on to other media, I really need to talk with you because I didn't talk to you about Financial Lives. I'll bring it up now.
Yeah.
So in Financial Lives, you have this really intriguing virtual adultery, the way that you broach that in that book with the wife. And in this, you take great care as well with Claire to show that she pines for the digital hit.
Yeah.
To my knowledge, I don't think I've read any other novelist who has openly confessed, yes, we go for our phone first and check our stuff.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I'm wondering about this interest of yours in depicting digital life in your books, the fact that we are enslaved to technology, because it comes off in a way that is... it comes off in a way that is lived in, as opposed to when you see some novelists bring up some technological element, it's very right. clear that they don't use the phones, or they're like asking someone, they don't really understand
right.
it.
Right.
But you know, I'm curious about, you know, why, I mean, is it just a reflective of what you're trying to capture about our culture right now, the digital concern, the digital addiction, the digital loneliness, and
yeah.
that sort of
thing? Yeah, it is the world we live in, certainly, you know, and so that's a big part of it. It's, I do like to exaggerate those things that,
yeah.
And I hate that about myself, that I sleep with my iPhone on the bedstand, you know,
yeah.
and I have to force myself to not check it first, you know,
yeah.
and I should probably say hi to my wife, you know, and maybe look out, and I have a window right there, and I'll sometimes hit the weather button to see what the weather is
yeah.
outside, rather than looking out the window at the weather. How
insane
is that?
It's the same in our household. Yeah.
Right. How nuts is that? And so, yeah, you know, I think another of the novelist's job is, you know, you're an absurdity miner, and so when Claire wakes up and she joneses for data and takes a digital hit, you
yeah.
know, that's kind of what it feels like, is this, you know, all right, now I can face my day, you know, and with Financial Lives of the Poets, you know, that's what this technology seemed like to me. And the funny thing was, after that book came out, people kept coming up to me and saying, oh my God, you know, did you know so-and-so was, you know, seeing her old boyfriend from high school? I said, no. Well, you wrote about it. And I, you know, there were so many people going through that with ex-spouses, ex-girlfriends, ex-boyfriends, that, you know, it was an accidental zeitgeist moment, because it seemed to me more plausible than anything I'd experienced. You know, my Facebook, like most authors, you know, people go there and,
yeah.
you know, post things, but it tends not to be as personal as all that.
In terms of how you observe various people, and it seems to me what we're establishing with the digital thing and with much of your behavior is that you're looking for something that is absurd, but that is also motivated by a truth that
yeah.
that everybody can relate to. So, you know, this leads me to ask, well, you know, how do you observe things? How do you go from like the collective things that you see around you, behavior of digital obsession or other forms of obsession, and what is the filtering process? I mean, it would seem to me that it would probably be a very intuitive and accidental thing, but on the other hand, if something is absurd, it's going to rise to the top. So, you know, what do you do?
I think it is and it isn't. It is intuitive, but I'm also, again, looking for those places where it intersects with our lives, with the general, the specific and the general. And so, for instance, Financial Lives of the Poets is a great example. That novel began with me in a 7-Eleven seeing these guys buying munchies and remembering being in that position.
Yeah.
And having this moment where I could remember being them, and I felt a sort of sorrow about getting old, but also relief that I wasn't those guys. And where those places intersected is where the novel begins, with Matt, who really wants to be a younger, better version of himself. And so does his wife. Everyone in that book has, you know, wakes up one morning and they're way behind on their house, but they're also 10 years older than they feel like. And so when I find those things, then the powers of observation, so hearing those guys talk,
yeah.
You know, watching them spill a giant Sprite, you know, looking at the munchies they buy, you know, that whatever conversation they have, you know, that and as a journalist, I was constantly observing people. I like to immerse myself in things and just record what went on around me, that fly on the wall thing. And
yeah.
And so if I can connect with it, then I can hopefully connect other people with it. So a lot of times these are things that hit me in a certain way. I write a lot about, you know, a lot of my short stories, especially, are about fatherhood.
Yeah.
Because it hits me in such a profound way. And so, you know, where those absurdities and anxieties intersect with fatherhood, and where I feel it personally in my gut, that's when I know that that's a place to mine. That's a nerve to dig into.
So here's the question for you. I mean, a journalist is going to have a specific angle that is going to trigger a specific question that will then create, well, if I follow this line, I will hopefully dredge up a story or dig up a story. So, you know, as a fiction writer, what happens if you don't have that specific angle? You have to have something to materialize out of thin air. Is it going to come to you sooner or later? Is that kind of the way things work with a novel?
You know, you I never have a big idea for a novel. I never wake up in the morning and say, you know, today I will write a novel about, you know.
Oh, no, but we're talking like an angle, like the 7-Eleven moment, for example.
Yeah, and that's usually what happens to me, is I find a way in. And once I find a way in, it's usually through character. And I think character is the elemental thing. Finding my way into Pasquale and Dee, and infusing them with wants, you know, like most novels do. They, you know, Pasquale wants the world to come to his village, you know, and then you know, dealing with him in those ways. But I think you know, once I spot the thing that feels like it should be part of a novel, then it just becomes one of 100 things, you know. With this book, I mean, you can see what my preoccupations were: Hollywood and fame and telling stories and writing and love and a kind of existentialism. You know, can one moment exist more powerfully than others? Those were the kinds of things I was just thinking about the last 15 years.
Sure.
You know, Financial Lives of the Poets. It started out being, okay, here's this guy falling apart, but I wanted to write about newspapers, the death of newspapers. And I wanted to write about senility because I'd had an aunt who recently had dementia. So that became part of it. I've described it before, and I hate retreading things, but like a magpie flying around looking for little bits of garbage to go back and make a nest with. And I never know which bottle tabs, which pieces of foil, which gum wrappers are going to look good in my nest. And they look like garbage to anyone else. But to me, I see the Donner Party and I think that belongs in a novel.
Yeah.
And I swoop down and pick it up and I pack it into my little novel and I make it all fit and connect, hopefully. And, you know, thus a novel comes eventually.
So. Did you see that Crispin Glover movie about the Donner Party?
You know, the funny thing is,
it's really bad, but I
saw a few minutes of it because I wrote this entire thing and I thought, you know, what's the least likely Hollywood movie that would ever get made?
And then sure enough, there it is.
And sure enough, it exists, right? Or a version of it exists.
Yes. Yeah. And speaking of movies, I actually wanted to ask you, you know, how much research did you do into Richard Burton? How many books did you read? Did you watch all of his films systematically? Like, there's a moment where a character says, well, I'm watching all of Burton's movies in chronological order. I don't want to give it away. But, like, you know, it's right before the downfall around 67.
Right. And you can track that in his legs, because his legs turn to, like, by the end, like, they're, you know, they're taping messages to his legs. They're like pigeon legs, you know. I watched Cleopatra first, and I saw this blonde woman as Elizabeth Taylor's lady in waiting, and I thought, how strange to cast a blonde woman in ancient Egypt, you know. But also couldn't take my eyes off Burton, who was just this powerhouse. And then I didn't watch all the movies, but I watched many of them, read various biographies, and you know, he was this rake and this womanizer, and it was great fun just to imagine him. And he sort of hovered over the book, and it was in the middle of that research when I found the piece in the New Yorker about David Cabot, in which Cabot had Burton on as a guest, and he was described as a beautiful ruin.
Yeah.
And that, when I read that phrase, it was like this kick to my chest. And I couldn't believe how many times in the book I had already had the phrase ruins or artifacts. And I realized these people are all beautiful ruins. They're all flawed in some way. And it's their flaws that make them so interesting to me. That's what makes them human. That's what makes me want to write about them. Every story that they tell is a kind of ruin. This book is made up of artifacts, of a bit of this and a piece of that. It's like you've come across this village and there's a piece of a play and there's part of a memoir and there's part of a Hollywood tell-all, and there's, you know, and you put together, you know, you can look at the lives these people lived by putting those ruins together. So, yeah, Burton ended up being kind of the soul of the book in a funny way. The drunk soul, the very drunk soul.
Well, when Burton does show up, he has this nonstop soliloquy, basically.
Yeah.
He cannot stop jabbering. And there's very little room for description when he's there. But it's interesting because I wanted to ask you, it's like, you know, well, is there a certain statute of limitations on a public figure? Has he been dead long enough for you to go ahead and he doesn't exactly come across very well in this book.
I would disagree. I mean, if I read it, there's a book about, I forget what it's called, but it's about four actors.
Yeah.
He and Peter O'Toole, and I forget the other two. And it's just about what you know, all the women they slept with and all the booze they drank, you know? So I don't feel like I've slandered anyone, you know? I mean, it's like if I wrote, you know...
The record is already public enough on Burton.
Right. Yeah, and besides that, I do think he comes across as kind of a fascinating guy and a guy...
Oh, he's definitely interesting and he's compelling, but I mean, he's also just, you know, I mean, I don't want to give it away, but he's not exactly classy in the way that is handled.
And I think that's open to you know, to interpretation.
That's true.
You know, did Michael Dean manipulate him, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the question that I kind of wanted to leave open. You know, he, you know, does he, you know, because he does go try to find Dee, you know, I won't say what. Why, but and yet it does leave that question open, but I don't know. I mean I don't know about statutes of limitations or anything. I know with public figures you're pretty much free to write about them.
Well, of course, and if they're dead, they're dead, and you can do whatever you want.
Well, and I also thought it was kind of, in my mind, you know, he was a fascinating character, and that's all we ever get to be. Nobody gets to be noble and good because we aren't, you know, but fascinating is I'll take that.
Michael Dean, we have to talk about, especially this first chapter, There's Abandon, which actually, I guess, has that same sort of Burton allure, because I was reading this and I was going, you know, this guy's not, you know, we've already established that he's not exactly the greatest guy, but in this, when he's telling his own story, the thing about that that's fascinating, and even though he's referring to himself as the Dean, and he lays down the "we want what we want" mantra, I'm reading this and it's like, actually, I'm kind of being seduced by this guy. I can understand.
That's so fun.
I can understand that. But I wanted to ask you because, you know, what's interesting is that there's that. There is also the play. There is also, of course, the Smile of Heaven, which is the Albus Bender fragment, which relies too much on the whole sock thing. But, you know, but what's interesting about these respective moments is that they're kind of like bad or adequate writing.
Right.
And yet you read them and then there's something poignant that comes out of it. And I'm curious, you know, if you deliberately wanted to smudge the writing so you could actually force yourself into this point of emotional sincerity, or you could, or that this was really the only way for some of these characters to announce their visceral intentions for you, the author, and subsequently the reader.
I think both those things.
Yes.
I do think you're trying to inhabit the voice of those characters. Albus Bender is a failed novelist. Why is he a failed novelist? Because he has this sort of meaningless story that he just keeps circling in his head. But yet you want to give him, I hope, glimmers of talent and something interesting in there, and a story that he feels genuinely about. You know, the two examples of that that I was the most nervous about and which surprised me to this day are the pitch for Donner, which is ludicrous on its face. And yet by the end, I felt like that big moment where he describes all of a sudden the cars going past and then he's just a man alone, you know, having lost his family. I was incredibly moved. You know, a literary journal excerpted that part because they loved it so much.
Wow.
You know, and it's such a strange form. So the form told part of it. I was writing very much in their voice. Michael Dean's chapter, there's not a single comma in that whole chapter.
Yes, that's right.
And I wanted it to just chug along. This is a guy who never pauses, never looks back, and so he moves forward with declarative sentence after declarative sentence. And so, yeah, the writing became in this, you know, the writing was infected by the character, which was infected again by the writing. They became kind of one and the same.
Yeah.
And it's a bit odd. I had that same feeling in The Financial Lives of the Poets when I'm writing poetry for a character.
Mm-hmm.
And I write some poetry, but I started thinking, you know, I've got to make this guy a worse poet than I am, which is hard because I'm a bad poet.
Yeah.
But it's not going to, you know, I can't care too much about the poems in here or they won't be his.
Yeah.
You know, and with Michael Dean, the writing had to reflect him. And so it becomes another kind of play, which I love play in writing. I love when I'm having fun. And I was having a great time writing a bad Hollywood tell-all, you know.
But it sounds to me that you were writing these sections so you could actually believe in these characters.
Very much so. And they have to get to a point where, Michael Dean, no one thinks they're the villain of their own story.
Yeah.
It's impossible to think that. And Michael Dean believes that he knows best for people. Imagine what a pressure that would be to think only you know what people want. This guy tells you something, but you can see through him and you know what he wants. It's a kind of, you know, it's a responsibility that he sees that he has. We see it as this just horribly manipulative Machiavellian, you know, producer who's had, you know, so much plastic surgery and Botox that he looks like a child, you know.
Yeah.
But everyone in their story comes arrives at the place where they can not only defend their actions, but their actions seem inevitable and worthy and honorable and noble, you know.
Yeah. One last question. I wanted to actually bring up this Washington Post review. Allegra Goodman, she wrote and she accused you of extending a moment two or three beats too long. But when I was waiting for you downstairs, I was watching this fascinating moment with the desk clerk and this woman who was staying at the hotel, and she kept repeating, you know, I need an 8 a.m. bus.
Yeah,
I need an
8
a.m.
Right,
bus,
right.
And just going on and on and on and on. Yeah. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier about this tension between, you know, how one tells a story versus how one lives. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you feel that you can get away with in terms of, I suppose, perhaps extending a beat too much? I mean, you can't obviously please everybody.
Right.
You know, on the other hand, you have to give the reader something so that they kind of feel the time of that moment. So, you know, what do you do, you know, to, I mean, is this part of the whole belief thing we were talking about, you were talking about earlier, this in the last answer?
I think there are two or three things that go into it, you know. And first of all, with reviews, I've been so fortunate that to have a writer or two have a few quibbles is you know, I really can't complain. And I'm sure every time I go through a book, I find five or six places where I feel like I went on too long, or I chose the wrong word, or I barely wrote in English. But as far as those moments themselves, and there's a kind of verisimilitude that you want to strive for. But if we wrote conversations as they occur, it could just be deadly awful, you know. And so you're looking for something that is kind of artful, but not showingly, that it doesn't show itself as artful. It's disguised as reality, but it's really in the same way that a painting is not, you know, the paintings that we really respond to aren't the ones that look exactly like photographs, but they have some kind of abstraction to them. And so dialogue is one of those things that has to do that. A moment in a book has to do that. As I said, this book was bigger and more fanciful, and I probably pushed on the emotional buttons harder than I normally would have. So I'm not surprised that a reader or two might respond and say that the emotion was pushed too much in a couple of places. And it doesn't really, you know, I've yet to see the perfect novel. And so when I find out I haven't written one, it doesn't really break my heart too much.
Would you say, though, a certain degree of bad writing, so to speak, is necessary to get at this moment that we're talking about? That you have to be both beautiful and bad at the same time.
I mean, it was definitely a preoccupation of this novel. I mean, it's the highest and the lowest of culture in this novel. You've got reality shows, you know, called, you know, Drunk Midget House and
Hook Book.
And Rich MILF, Poor MILF, you know, you know, right alongside Burton, one of the great Shakespearean actors of his time. You know, you've got people aspiring to higher art and lower art, and it was a collision of the high and the low, and I'm curious about where those things intersect, you know. And in the end, I feel like whatever heartfelt things are in the book are not faked, and they feel earned to me by the characters. Obviously, I wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, if I felt that it was manipulative in some way that wasn't right, I probably would have tried to fix that. You know.
Would you say though that the high-low collision comes more from the collision in language or what you're emotionally feeling at that particular time?
Both, I think. Yeah. And what we respond to, you know, I think the book's very much about art. You know, there are some paintings in the book in a machine gun nest in a bunker on the coast of Italy that are chipped and fading and falling apart. And in my mind, they were the most beautiful paintings. You know, I can close my eyes and still see them.
And don't forget the Polaroid as well.
What's that?
The Polaroid. That
yeah, right, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, right. And so, I think. You know, I do think I think that high and low, you know, one of the things I really like for some reason is the end of the book, Claire, who's a, and this won't give anything away, but she's a filmmaker, yeah. She finally decides she wants to make this movie about a singer, and I love all of the compromises that come about in her movie. You know, it's no longer this, and now it's set in Detroit, and now it's not the mother, it's not the father, but it's the mother, and you know, and this character works with low-income teens, and you know, all those things that happen in Hollywood that just carve the edges off, and yet by the end she's still kind of proud of it, you know, and to me that was that sort of lesson of, you know, being these weathered ruins where all the edges have been worn off by time and sand and rain, and yet there we stand.
So writing can never truly capture romance like this. You're always going to have the edges sanded off, which is why the moments are seemingly off stage near the end of the book.
Right. Yeah. I did sort of start with the premise that perhaps the most profound romantic moment is the one that isn't realized, because then it's all potential. It can only exist in that way. And then it was creating such a moment and trying to imagine what it might mean to these two characters. And so because of that, I also wanted, I wanted, you know, some ending that allowed it also to end that way, you know, without it really being realized in front of our eyes.
Well, let's hope that this ended in some natural manner.
Yeah, right.
Jess,
right.
Thanks so much. It was a
pleasure.
Yeah,
thanks, Ed. It's always good to talk to you.
You're walking taller than you should. The air is thin around your beautiful head. You're saying things with your mouth to me.